Members, I'm going to commence the meeting at this time. We do not have a quorum, but we have a full agenda, and so we're going to continue on with the department's technical bill. We've gone through the first three articles. We're moving on to Article 4. Members, in your packet, you should find House File 896. And again, we're moving on to Article 4 in House File 896. Mr. Melcher.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I'd like to review the changes that are proposed in Article 4 of the Department Administrative Bill. Beginning on page 43 of the bill and page 5 of the department summary, the first recommendation, and this is included in sections 1, 4, and 5 of Article 4, would be to authorize the commissioner to exempt projects that are approved under the Alternative Facilities Bonding and Levy Program.
Mr. Melcher, if you could... just a second, we do have enough members now to have a quorum. Members, I officially call this meeting to order. Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, currently school districts are required to do a formal review and comment on all facilities projects that exceed a cost of $500,000 per building. School districts also go through a review and approval process on their alternative facilities projects for deferred maintenance costs. In some cases, this is kind of a double burden on the school districts to go through both the alternative facilities process and the review and comment process. And quite frankly, in some cases, the review and comment process doesn't fit the alternative facilities projects very well. It's designed more for a school district building a new building as opposed to a school district fixing the roof or replacing worn out carpet or other sorts of issues. And so the department is recommending that the commissioner have authority to waive the review and comment process for projects that are being reviewed and approved under the alternative facilities program. Section 2 of the bill deals with the public notice for alternative facilities projects, and Mr. Chairman, there is an amendment dealing with that section of the bill.
Members, I'm going to move the A05-0100 amendment to be before the committee. Mr. Melcher, please explain the amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, under current law, there's no direction provided to school districts for the timing of the public notice to be provided on alternative facilities bonding projects, and the original drafting of the bill called for a 60-day notice, and after discussing that with the School Board Association, we agreed that 60 days would create some problems for districts in terms of the timing, and that 20 days would be sufficient to provide adequate public notice. And so the amendment would change that 60-day provision in the bill to a 20-day provision.
All right. Is there any comments by anyone in the audience? Ms. Schwab? Would please. Ms. Schwab, welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Schwab, and I'm the Director of Governmental Relations for MSBA. We did work with the department and spent some time discussing that the 20-day limit works with a lot of our other review and comment notices we have to publish, and we could still go to the 60 days if we so chose. So we appreciate the department's willingness to work with us on this.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Schwab, do you have an obligation to notify the public in this case, and is 20 days enough time for that?
Ms. Schwab.
Yes, we do. 20 days. We have three different notices that go out, with public notices that go out and published notices that go out. So definitely, and they all have different timelines. One is a 60 days. Help me, Tom. What are the other?
Well, Mr. Chairman
and
Representative Sikora, one of the issues that this bill is attempting to address was that there are different timeline requirements for the review and comment process as opposed to the issuance of bonds or the notification of levies under the alternative facilities proposal. And we were trying to avoid the need for a school district to do multiple notices for the same project. So rather than doing one notice at the time you do the review and comment and another notice at the time you're getting ready to issue the bonds or make the levy, this is trying to put that down into one notice, which would be 20 days before the action is taken.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sikora.
So I would understand, Mr. Melcher, that then it's quite common to have the 20-day notice period. This isn't something terribly unique.
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sikora, no. I think this would work and provide ample time for review by the public before the decision is made by the school board.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Seeing none, I renew my motion on the 05-0100 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, Section 3 of Article 4 on page 44 of the bill is clarifying the uses of the capital project referendum revenue. Currently, one of the primary uses that school districts make of the capital project referendum revenue is for the purchase of computers and telecommunications equipment and for personnel costs directly related to the maintenance of that technology equipment. And under the current capital project referendum statute, it's not clear in terms of the uses and whether these technology items can be included in the use of the capital projects referendum. And what this language does is clarifies that and specifically ties the uses of the capital project referendum to the same uses that are specified in statute currently for the operating capital revenue. Mr. Chairman, that pretty well finishes off Article 4 of the bill, and I could move to Article 5 if you wish. Article 5 makes changes in the early childhood and family support area. The first section, Sections 1 and 2, clarify the application of the 5% administration limit on ECFE and school readiness programs. Currently, the application of the 5% limit is not clear in terms of whether that applies to 5% of the aid and levy or 5% of the total revenue in the program. What this clarification would do is to tie the 5% to the total revenue for the program, which includes the aid, the levy, and the fees. So we're looking at a kind of an overall 5% limit tied to the overall program revenue. Otherwise, it's difficult for the department to administer the law when it's not clear which categories are subject to the 5% limit and which categories aren't. Mr. Chairman, Sections 3 through 5 of the bill, Article 5, would amend the compensatory education statute to allow school districts to allocate a portion of the compensatory revenue for pre-kindergarten programs for children ages 3.5 to 5 who are eligible for free and reduced lunch. And this came from Karen Carlson's area in the department, and my understanding of the rationale for this was that in some cases it was felt that providing school districts flexibility to use compensatory dollars earlier would perhaps enable school districts to address some of the learning needs of those children at an earlier age and perhaps reduce the need for some of the compensatory expenditures when the children are a little bit older. So that was the effort here, was to be a little bit more preventative in some of the uses of the compensatory revenue as opposed to waiting until the children are further along in their educational program.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much of what was cut last year in early childhood programs will that replace?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dreiling, the amount that could be allocated under this provision is up to 10% of the compensatory revenue the district receives. So currently a district is required to expend 95% of the compensatory revenue at the building that the students are in that generated the revenue. This would change that to 85% and allow the district to take 10% of the compensatory revenue and use it for pre-K programs. We currently have programs in a number of districts that were providing, for example, four-year-old kindergarten programs that had been receiving funding but that are not currently receiving funding because they don't meet the definition of kindergarten. Those programs are funded through a transition revenue device. So the money could be used to supplement those, or it could be used for other early childhood programs. I think trying to tie it to the changes that were made earlier, for example, you had the reduction in the early childhood family education program that I think was targeted more to a younger age. It's hard to identify that precisely because of the fact that the compensatory does vary quite a bit from district to district. So clearly a district that had a high concentration of poverty would have more compensatory money that it could move to early childhood than a district that had less concentration of poverty.
Representative Garland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Melcher, but surely you could take a stab at it.
looking around to see if Ms. Carlson might be in a better position than I am to do that. I'm sorry. I don't have... Oh, there you are.
Ms. Carlson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. I'm Karen Carlson from the Department of Education. One thing in this provision is that the children have to be eligible, and the eligibility is based on free and reduced lunch. So there wouldn't be a dollar-for-dollar kind of makeup provision couldn't happen because ECFE is not restricted to those children. So any program expenditures in this provision would have to go just for eligible children.
Mm-hmm. Representative Greiling.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Carlson, but Head Start was cut and wasn't learning readiness cut, you know, so I'm just wondering, kind of like a quid pro quo, dollar for dollar, and then of course wasn't also compensatory cut, so now we're taking money out of there and putting it in another place. But I'm just trying to ascertain, because I think front loading is a good idea regardless of the fact that we also need it for compensatory, so we're robbing Peter to pay Paul. But I'm just, so I understand that, but I also was just trying to get a handle on, roughly speaking, the cuts that were made to early childhood, which I just thought were probably the worst thing we did last year amongst many worst things, how much this, you know, does to replace that, given all the qualifications, I realize. But Head Start and Learning Ready, those would be programs that also would these dollars could be used for.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Grayling. On a statewide basis, this would actually come to more sheer dollars than the cuts, because this up to 10% would be about $26 million. So that would more than cover the cut if it could be distributed that way.
Thank you. Representative Sikor.
Well, I would just like to mention that when this whole idea came up, it was the result of attendance at a National Governors Conference there. The focus was early childhood. That and all the research that we've seen that indicates that, you know, a little early intervention makes a long-term difference. And the idea is that maybe putting 10% into some of the children who are at risk saves that much money later, because they won't need the help in reading. They won't need to have all that special ed help that we now provide to kids just because they fall behind. They start behind and they stay behind. And so this is a way, I think, of front-ending it, allowing schools the flexibility if they feel the need. And I granted a lot of schools don't have much compensatory, but the areas that have the most at-risk kids do have compensatory. And I think it's pretty proven that this could work.
Representative Erickson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and to that point, Representative Greiling, this is an opportunity for us, as Representative Sikor pointed out, this is a recommendation that came out of that conference, and this is an opportunity for us to take those at-risk children along with their parents and use this four-year-old program. So I think we have to look at this as an opportunity, not concentrate on the past, but look to the future.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was done, but I can't let that go by. I just can't bear to be lectured to about the benefits of early intervention when I protested the cuts last year. So that's my point. I am looking forward, and I'm trying to see how much this does to rectify what was done last year, and it sounds like it more than compensates for it. Now, when we get around to funding compensatory and what kind of a hole we have there, we'll have a whole nother discussion. But I'm not objecting. I'm looking forward and supporting putting the money into the early childhood. I think I know all those arguments. But I also know that we have kids who come into our school system from other states and other places who aren't going to have been front-loaded, and also the front-loading doesn't always take care of everything when families continue to have struggle and have problems. So I'm trying to make a positive statement about Assistant Commissioner Carlson's recommendation in light of what we did last year, and I'm glad somebody's looking at that now. But the discussion about the whole and compensatory will be another discussion where we can all preach to each other and decide what to do about that.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Mr. Melcher, continue.
Mr. Chairman and members, the last article of the bill is the prevention article, and that transfers the lead abatement program from the Department of Education to the Department of Health. Department of Health currently has statutory authority in programs relating to lead prevention, and that would be more compatible with their mission than with the Department of Education.
Okay.
And that concludes the bill.
Members, do we have any questions? Seeing none, members, in your packet there are two amendments. We will take the A5 amendment at this time, and I believe I will call on Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'd like to move the A5 amendment. This is a discussion that I began in committee and continued with Assistant Commissioner Nelson over how we could make the basic reading instruction more understandable and more user-friendly. And so if you take a look at some of the language changes, I'm recommending we delete comprehensive scientifically based reading and change that to effective reading instruction. And then if you notice in line 9 of the amendment, the reading of this program, I think, is more understandable, more friendly to those who will need to apply it. And another change is that on line 1 of page 22, that not only are we assessing and evaluating, but I believe this recommendation came from Representative Sandy Peterson, that we also insert and communicating the students' reading progress. And I am changing learners to students, the singular possessive in this case. So, Mr. Chair, that's in brief an explanation of the amendment.
Comments on the amendment, Assistant Commissioner Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department supports the amendment.
Okay. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, could you tell me, I know that when we have reading instruction, we always have controversy, and has this been, who has this been run by, like the reading experts in the department and at the university and so forth? Often we have good debates on reading wording, and so just to change this without anybody present, I'm wondering who was worked with on this and if there was buy-in.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, this was run by experts. In fact, I have a letter here from the Minnesota Reading Association, and this whole trying to improve the basic definition and the thrust of reading instruction has been worked on by a committee of the Reading Association, including the president and other names such as Michael Graves, Al Greenfield, Dick Pearl, and Terry Bitluski, who's the president. We also worked from the core with people in the department whose job it is to evaluate higher ed reading programs. Mm-hmm. And we worked with the Board of Teaching, Executive Director, the former and the current, have worked with us, and they're both supportive of this particular provision as well. So we think we've covered the bases. Mm-hmm. Now this amendment we have embedded through everybody, but the bottom line is what experts are telling us is it's just common sense. If we want our children to read better, we need to do everything we can to take a look at the programs that are preparing them and to align those programs with what experts say are the core fundamentals of good reading instruction.
Any further questions, Representative Garland? All right, seeing no further questions, prepared to vote. All those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Members, in your packet is the A6 amendment. The A6 amendment deals with concerns that were brought forward by MSBA. And I'm going to, at this time, offer the A6 amendment to be before the committee and ask that Ms. Larson take us through the A6 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members, the A6 amendment is designed to say that if the school board publishes its report electronically, it must publish notice of the report in a periodical of general circulation so that it's not duplicative. It's simply that if there is a published report, there's no need for notice. But if the report is electronic, then there is a need for notice. In addition, the School Boards Association raised the issue of including a representative of non-public schools in Article 3 on page 41. Including on the Parent Advisory Council, a representative of the non-public schools, Ms. Schwab raised the issue of the possibility that there may be an instance, one or more instances, where there is no public school. So the language now clarifies that the requirement for a representative of a non-public school on the council exists except when there is no non-public school located in that particular district.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Ms. Schwab, you don't need to come to the table, but if we can see a nod of the head one way or the other, does MSBA support this amendment? She's nodding her head yes, for the record. Mr. Sullivan or Assistant Commissioner Nelson, how's the department on this amendment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we support this amendment. Thank you.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, we're prepared to vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. 2, the bill. Are there any further questions? Seeing none, then I renew. I'm going to take that back. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak to the agency bill? Seeing a show of hands. All right. Ms. Allschweiger, welcome. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jan Allschweiger, Education Minnesota. And I just wanted to call your attention to, I believe it's Article 2, Section 11. I had a science teacher call me yesterday. I was in the process of trying to talk to Ms. Bowie about this. There is a the provision states that it would allow a currently licensed science teacher to take the Praxis 2 test for a different area of science in order to be licensed to teach in a different area of science. This gets to the issue about having qualified teachers teaching our students. The most significant factor in raising student achievement is making sure that you have highly qualified, licensed teachers teaching in the area in which they are licensed. Chemistry is very different than life science. Life science is biology. Physics is very different than other science areas. So we would urge you to take a little longer look at this piece of legislation. We would recommend that this go to the Board of Teaching and actually go through rulemaking process so that a more thorough discussion could be held about this provision. Putting this in a bill like this could have some significant implications on the achievement of students, especially at a time when we want students to do better in math, science, and reading. Those are the three areas I think that we hear the most about. So allowing somebody to teach physics when they are licensed to teach chemistry or another area could have an impact. I realize the reason that this is being done is that we have some shortage areas, but lowering or making it easier to become a licensed teacher in a different area isn't always the right way to do it. We don't want to make it easier to be a licensed teacher. We want to maintain the standards that we feel are appropriate. So we feel that the best solution would be to have the Board of Teaching go through rulemaking to make sure that it is thoroughly discussed. And as I said, there was a science teacher that deals with the science teaching organization that has some input and would like to have more discussion on this issue.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Osweiger, at least it's my understanding that the Board of Teaching is dealing with this issue. When we attended a luncheon, Cindy Growling and I, Representative Growling and I attended a luncheon the other day with the Board of Teaching. This was one of the questions that came up, and they said they were dealing with trying to come to some determination about what would be a satisfactory solution to getting these people licensed in that other areas of science. And there seemed to be a lot of discussion about what would be appropriate, and certainly the Board of Teaching should be able to work through that process to be sure that teachers are highly qualified by the time they get their license.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson,
Ms. Osweiger,
you might be more up to speed on the Board of Teaching's position or where they're at that if you've just had a discussion with them. So it sounds like that the suggestion to have the Board of Teaching work on it might be a good one.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I attended the same luncheon, and what Representative Peterson is stating is accurate. Furthermore, members, if we look at Subdivision 4 of Section 11, we are directing the board to adopt in each one of those points of the Subdivision 4. So I believe by rereading what is in law now, the board will have to have a hearing on this, and so there will be public input.
Representative Griley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In light of this discussion, I would, for purposes of further discussion in the committee now, I would move that we remove Article 2, Section 11, and wait on it until we hear from the Board of Teaching.
Assistant Commissioner Nelson, would you come forward, please? Assistant Commissioner, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would never purport to represent the Board of Teaching, but I have had conversation with the Board of Teaching Executive Director, in fact, yesterday. There is a Standard and Rules Committee process that is in place for the Board of Teaching, and they are discussing quite actively another means that's different than this one to try to respond to the requests of schools to do something. Because we have almost 500 teachers right now who are teaching science to students who are not fully licensed for that area that they're teaching science. We have had a five-fold increase in the numbers of variances requested by teachers who are teaching science. The executive director, Alan Hoffman, can better report this, but his comments to me yesterday were that they are going to be voting as a Board of Teaching at the March 11th meeting on this other proposal, if this other proposal is accepted by the whole board and they have to deliberate and decide. He expects that it would take about a year and a half for this to work its way through working on what the standards would be, because what they're talking about is a new preparation that would be a general science preparation for teachers who already have a license in science, and that process would involve working with higher ed to identify what the standards for the training would be and then having to go through a rulemaking process. We think this is much more expedited. We have a need out there. The numbers of variances are growing. And I might add that this proposal the department put forward was developed with science teachers. In fact, they're science teacher content specialists and teachers that are considered classroom teachers experts across the state of Minnesota. It's important we move forward on this one.
Representative Kammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have an amendment on the table?
We do, Representative Gemmer. I believe if I can restate, Representative Greiling moves to delete Article 2, Section 11 from the bill. Representative Gemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to, I guess, support. I was going to speak before Deputy Commissioner Nelson spoke, but I got to agree with her from the school district I'm from. We dealt with this issue when I was on the school board over and over again, life sciences and physical science teachers. There's no way we could have a teacher in both of those disciplines and have enough work to keep them going, and we had operated under variances most of the time. And the variances were worked out with either physical or life science teachers teaching the other, and worked with the teachers, worked with the administrators, really felt that our school district and the professionals there were doing a good job making sure that we did have qualified people. This makes a lot of sense. It's common sense, I think, for a lot of our school districts in rural Minnesota, and I would speak strongly in favor of not adopting the amendment and adopting the language in this bill.
All right. In favor of not. So you oppose the amendment, Representative Demmer?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Erickson. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, Mr. Chair, I'll pass.
All right. Representative Peterson.
Chair and Ms. Nelson, is there any other route to getting, besides, you know, the program that they're embarking on, what about the house standards or the portfolio? Are those available for these science areas?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, yes, they are. The portfolio is a process that's available by application for people who think they can demonstrate through paper and testimonials and documents that they have achieved the Minnesota standards for a particular licensure area. So, yes, that is in place. It's just beginning and growing, and frankly, we're trying to make that more known. There is also something called a house process, which is temporary. The portfolio would lead to a regular license. The house process, high objective uniform state system of evaluation, we love acronyms, that house process is out there for teachers who are currently licensed, who may not have licensure in one additional area, such as a science area. They can use what is called a house process, which is a quick way to demonstrate that they do have the qualifications to teach, but the intent is eventually that they get the full licensure. What this department bill does is recognize that Minnesota standards have already been achieved by a teacher. They're already in the classroom. They have already gone through a higher ed preparation program, and they're passing what is a rigorous content test. And so the idea being that would demonstrate they have the qualifications to be able to teach.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nelson, you may have just answered my question, but I know I should know what the Praxis 2 test is, but I just don't. And I guess my core question is it content specific in terms of life science, earth science, physics, chemistry, whatever? Is it more broad field across science? Can you help me to better understand the test?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, the Praxis is a subject assessment, and it is particular to that content area. It's called the Praxis 2 Subject Assessment and Specialty Area Exam. And there are Praxis 2 subject assessment specialty exams available in every area that we provide licensure in, except for reading, and that one's very close to being finished. The other tests you're thinking of, Representative, are a basic skills test in reading, writing, and math, which are general across whatever field you're going into. And then we have something called the Principles of Learning and Teaching. Some people call it the pedagogy test. That one is general by grade level. While there are content-level pedagogy tests available, our Board of Teaching has not selected to use those. They use the general pedagogy test.
Thank you. Representative Dunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just looking at the language, and I guess just so I understand what I'm voting on, or would be voting on, as I look at the language on page 24, it seems to me that under O, the board must adopt rules to license qualified candidates, and my inclination is that I would like the board to be able to do that, adopt those rules and move forward. I'm not as sure of the relationship, and that's why I'm glad we have a board of teaching to sit down and wrestle with some of this, because I think I would need more expertise. But it looks to me like section 2 then gives further more specific direction over what the rule must be. And if I'm reading it correctly, if we were to keep the first section and delete the second one, it would still wouldn't foreclose anything. It would simply be more general in terms of the rule that the board would have to put forward. Am I seeing the relationship? I guess Ms. Nelson could answer that. Am I seeing the relationship correctly between the first section and the second section there, or the first sub-item and the second sub-item clause?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dorn, I'm not seeing what section you would delete. Perhaps you could identify it by page and line?
Well, as I understand it, we're deleting, the motion is to delete all of section 11.
That is correct, Representative.
And all of section 11, the new language is on page 24. So what we're doing is deleting the new language on page 24. Mm-hmm. And are you with me so far?
Yes.
And then under O, clause 1 is a general requirement that they adopt rules, but clause 2 then says they must adopt the specific rule for what to do with teachers holding a continuing license, and puts in a procedure. Are we not only telling them to adopt rules, but what the rules should look like that we're saying they must adopt? And I'm wondering if silence on clause 2 would still allow more discussion about the overall direction that they must adopt rules. I'm wondering.
Assistant Commissioner.
We could give them a second look without taking away the requirement that we'd like them to look all together.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dorn, that you would take away the whole heart if you took away section 2 or clause 2, lines 19 through 28.
Okay.
You would, in a sense, take away the option. Right now, the Board of Teaching can entertain rules. They are a separate entity from the department. They can do that. In fact, I might tell you, participating closely with the Board of Teaching, there has been a work group studying the science licensure in the Board of Teaching for almost 2 years or more. They have not come up with a solution until quite recently, and that is a parallel provision, which, by the way, we probably would support as well, because we're supporting any means to respond to the needs of schools. We are meeting on March 11 with the board. Alan Hoffman, the executive director, said he wasn't able to tell me at this stage if he had polled every member of the Board of Teaching, because I wanted to come here today and say they support it. I don't sense that there's a decision that's been made. In fact, we're going to be presenting it at their March 11 meeting, and I am hopeful that they will be supportive of this as well as the other means. We have an obligation to respond when our schools are not able to produce the licensed teachers that we need, and this has gone on for a very long time.
Representative Clemson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to clarify, what is the amendment that we are speaking about?
The amendment on the table is to delete Article 2, Section 11 from the bill. Representative Clemson.
It seems that would delete a whole series of rules that were previously in place for the board.
Representative Quincy, if I could ask for some clarification, by deleting this from this bill does not delete current law. It simply deletes the new language, which can be found on page 24, lines 16 to 28.
Okay. Then my question then is to this, to Ms. Nelson, how many years have the waivers been in the high numbers or the significant numbers that you are talking about. And primarily, can you give kind of a broad percentage as to where the waivers are being done? Are they primarily in the metro area or primarily in the outstate regions?
Assistant Commissioner.
We are putting, Mr. Chair, Representative Klinzing, we are putting together that data now in easy-to-understand table formats in a report that you call for called a Teacher Supply and Demand Study. So I don't have those right off the top of my head and able to answer this here without preparation, but I'm looking at a draft chart of personnel variances granted in science by licensure areas. And these are being tracked from the year 2000 to the year 2004. And we can see that there have been significant changes over the years in life science. From 2000, I'll make this quick, Mr. Chair. In 2000, there were 12 variances. We're up to 51 in 2004. In chemistry, there was one variance in the year 2000. We're up to 124 in 2004 and many of the years prior. I can give you a chart that shows you every year what the variances were. Physics went from 2 to 129. Earth and space science, 17 to 62. You get the idea.
Thank you. Representative Sikora.
I'd just like to comment, Mr. Chair. You know, we all visited schools just a few weeks ago. The school that my group happened to visit was an ALC. In there, you could definitely see the need for something like this. And we've been dragging our feet on it for years. And the problem is only getting worse with each passing year as rural schools shrink in size. And they're trying to figure out how they keep teachers who can address different subjects that their students may want to take. It seems to me if they can pass the Praxis content test, and if they've been teaching for years, they know the pedagogy. It's the content that would be important. So I'm having a little trouble understanding why, if they can pass this test, it's a big problem.
Thank you. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam, or Mr. Chair. Members, the reason I have this amendment is not to oppose the language necessarily. It's to pull it out of this non-controversial bill. We took out Representative Klinzing's charter school extracurricular activities bill. I support that, but I also supported taking it out because it's controversial, and we need to discuss it separately and vote on it separately. This topic I'm very sensitive to, and I, in fact, recommended that Representative Eakin look into it because he does represent rural schools, and I believe that he and others are. So it's my purpose in taking it out, to proposing to take it out today, is so that it can be discussed on its own merit separately. We tend to like this kind of a bill to not have the controversies in it. And so we have a nice clean vote separately, and other people can know where we're coming from. I also think, since the Board of Teaching is meeting in less than 2 weeks, that it makes sense to hear from them, and they can know that we're discussing this and want them to put a little more speed into their deliberations on having more flexibility. That it would be a courtesy not just to jump the gun when they're discussing this so very soon and have been for so long, to wait on this, and then have, if this bill, if they don't do anything and the bill comes forward again after March 11th, I may very well at that time to decide to support it anyway. But I just would like the topic to be not in this non-controversial bill, and for us not to mandate what they need to do before they've even had a chance to have their meeting in less than 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Seeing no further comments, Representative Greiling renews her motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail. Are there further questions to the bill? We have one other person wishing to comment. Ms. Ephraim, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of Ed Watch, and I just wanted to comment briefly on Article 5 and the Early Childhood Plan. And just to say that I really understand and appreciate the concerns about early childhood, and we also understand and appreciate the effort to limit this to children with needs and children that that might have a difficult time accessing preschool, and also appreciate the idea of school choice for early childhood programs. Just want to raise a couple of points for concern and further consideration. First of all, the programs aren't as effective as have been billed, and just want you to be aware of that. And just remind you of the auditor's report in 2001 on ECFE. They said studies of two-generation programs have generally found small or no effects on child development, although many have reported some positive impact on parenting skills. Kindergarten readiness, evaluation of the school readiness program have not provided definitive evidence of its effect. The department has sometimes declared that school readiness has a positive impact without acknowledging other possible explanation for the results of its evaluations. And to remind you that Georgia spent $1.15 billion on universal preschool for four-year-olds and found no change in test scores and no difference between those that participated and those that did not. And then finally, Head Start. Our auditor said no large-scale studies have examined the effects of Minnesota's Head Start program on its participants. And the most recent study of over 600 studies on 40 years and $50 billion and 20 million children in Head Start nationally said in 2003, Head Start is not fully achieving its stated purpose of promoting school readiness. Indeed, these low-income children continue to perform significantly below their more advantaged peers in reading and math once they enter school. So just to remember that these are not a panacea, and the other thing is the potential for strings if these programs for private schools are required to use the new department early childhood indicators of progress. We would have grave concern about that affecting private and religious programs, because those standards are vague, they're subjective, they're a rehash of the profile for preschoolers, and they're using extremely controversial material, such as the National Association of Education for Young Children's anti-bias curriculum. So I just would ask you all to be aware that if the bill would allow or require the state standards in early childhood to be required for these private programs, that we would definitely oppose it.
Right. Are there any questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Dr. Ephraim.
Thank you.
Right. Members, at this time I'm going to renew my motion that House File 896 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations as amended. Okay. Seeing no further questions, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. House File 896 as amended is passed on to the Committee on Governmental Operations. Members, next on the agenda is House File 1306. Representative Dean, if you would move to the front table. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the bill we just passed on to the next committee, just a thought to make you a little more comfortable on the amendment that didn't come out. One of the best professors of mathematics I ever had, a PhD in mathematics, told me a story about someone who asked him a question, what do you know about trigonometry? This is a PhD in math. He said, nothing, I haven't taught it yet. And you've got science teachers that have been teaching a while in a slightly different subject context in science. They probably know more about that subject they're not licensed in than a new teacher coming in out of college with the right major. So just a little comfort level there.
Thank you, sir. Representative Dean, if you would like to move your bill, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Matt Dean from House District 52B.
I'm here to introduce House File 1303 and recommend it to pass. This has to do with chartered public schools. It's the single sponsor bill. What this bill does is we have in law, each chartered school has a sponsor, and currently that could be the Department of Education, a individual school district, a university or college, or a nonprofit with certain stipulations of $2 million or more in end-of-year assets. What this bill does is it would expand that to include new 501c3 nonprofits that are brought together for the single purpose of a bill and of bringing this together for for a single sponsor charter. What this will do is it will allow greater specialization and focus from the nonprofit for the specific purpose of that charter school. And it will also bring more scrutiny, and it will also make them more accountable. So that's the real goal of expanding this. And I have with me today John Schrader from Education Evolving to expand on this a little bit more and also to answer some questions about it. Thank you.
Mr. Schrader, please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Schrader, and I'm here this morning representing Education Evolving, which is a joint venture of the Center for Policy Studies and Hammond University. And I also speak for the Minnesota Charter School Forum, which is a broad coalition of about 30 different organizations and individuals that support charter schools in Minnesota. The legislation that Representative Dean has put before you today is not a new idea. This was actually introduced in the last session and passed out of committee, passed the House, and actually was one of the casualties of the end of the session. Inability to arrive at a comprehensive omnibus education bill in conference committee. So we have it before you again. It was originally introduced in the bill that you just passed out of committee, taken out and reintroduced separately now by Representative Dean. A couple of weeks ago, one of my colleagues, Joe Graba, testified before the committee as a part of your general orientation for the session, and about the importance of having new schools and creating an open sector, as he described it, an environment in which new schools could be created and thrive and succeed. And at the end of his testimony, Representative Greiling said, to paraphrase, fine, so what do you want us to do? And this particular piece of legislation is one of several things that he mentioned in response to Representative Browning's question. And there are several other things on your agenda this morning that are part of that response as well. And another bill that we hope to introduce also dealing with strengthening sponsors. And that's really one of the key ingredients here in the open sector, an environment for having new and successful public schools. To have strong and effective sponsors that are authorizing and overseeing these schools. This legislation, as Representative Dean said, would actually amend the section that authorizes the different agencies that can grant charters. And the difference between these up to five nonprofit organizations and the nonprofit organizations that can already grant charters is that these would be new organizations created explicitly for this purpose and authorized explicitly by the commissioner. So they couldn't just any nonprofit like we have now that has at least $2 million in assets. These would have to be explicitly authorized and would be accountable to the commissioner for their performance. The legislation is really an acknowledgement, a continuing acknowledgement of lessons learned over the last 13 or 14 years here in Minnesota that we've had charter schools, that the sponsors are a critical element in determining the success of the charter schools, whether they're authorized in the first place and how they perform and whether their authority is allowed to continue through the renewal process. It's also a part of this gradual expansion that we've had in who can grant charters in Minnesota, originally just school districts, and we've added other types of agencies over time. There are three unique characteristics, though, besides the fact that they wouldn't have to have the $2 million in assets for these particular up to five nonprofits. First, they would be single purpose. They would have no other purpose than granting and overseeing charters, and that would be unique in Minnesota. There are some other states that have special purpose chartering authorities, state charter school boards or the D.C. Public Charter School Board in Washington, D.C., but this would be a first in Minnesota to have agencies that just focus on this purpose alone. They would also specialize in one or more areas of types of schools or needs, educational needs, that are unmet in the state and that have been identified by this entity. For example, they could focus just on schools that serve at-risk students or schools that serve a transition from high school to college or a transition from early childhood to elementary. They could focus on a particular geographic area. Whatever the unmet needs are that are identified and that the commissioner approves as part of their application. And finally, they would be proactive. Right now, our sponsors sit back and wait for proposals to be offered. These new organizations would actually put out RFPs and would really scour the state and scour the country for the best, promising models for improving education in the area in which they have focused. Just quickly and finally, there are four things that I want to make clear that this legislation is not intended to do. First of all, it's not an attempt to downgrade the importance of or replace the role of existing sponsors. We have had over 60 different organizations in Minnesota, about 30 school districts and the others higher education institutions and nonprofit organizations that have granted charters, and 40 some of those are still active chartering authorities in Minnesota. We have a number of efforts underway to strengthen those, and we intend to keep those and strengthen and make them even better at what they do in the future. This is also not intended to make it easier to get a charter. In fact, one of the premises here, because these are specialized organizations that do nothing else, is that they would be even more rigorous and more demanding of schools in the application process and in the oversight process. They would really be experts in the whole process of granting and overseeing charters, and we would expect that they would be even more rigorous and it perhaps would be even more challenging to get a charter through these special purpose sponsors. The objective of this legislation is also not to increase the number of schools, and we don't expect to see a net increase in the number of schools chartered just because of the existence of these special purpose organizations. We have, for a lot of reasons, kind of an uptick right now in the interest in charter schools and a growing number of applications and people stepping forward asking for the authority to operate charter schools. Growing enrollments, growing number of schools, and we expect to see that continue. But this is really intended to be more strategic about how that happens and make sure that it's done in a high quality manner. So the intent is not, and we would not expect to see a net increase in the number of charter schools because of the existence of these new organizations. And finally, this is not an attempt to create new bureaucracy or create demands for new state funding. On purpose, we've intended this to be very lean operations. They would be initially financed through grants or other private sources and through fees charged to the schools. On the long term, these would be self-sustaining organizations through the fees that they charge to the schools. So this is not going to require any new state appropriations. As you all know, and I've heard, you know, in recent weeks in your hearings, Minnesota has been a national leader in the broad area of public school choice over the last 20 years, for the last 13 or 14 years in the area of charter schools. This is another opportunity for Minnesota to step out front. This would be a unique new breakthrough in taking the functions related to chartering and sponsoring of charter schools to a new level. And we think would be of interest and attention not only in this state, but all across the country. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Shorter. Mr. Shorter, quick question. Representative Deans, piece of legislation here I noticed does not have a Senate author yet. You mentioned this bill was passed last year. Did it have a Senate author last year, and who was that Senate author?
Mr. Chairman, the legislation was introduced independently last year by Senator Kelly, and it's currently actually in the same bill that you just passed out, which I believe is being taken up in the Senate Education Committee this afternoon. And I don't know that there's been a determination made on the Senate side as to how to deal with this or other legislation that might be in the controversial category on the Senate side, whether they intend to pull this and others out of that bill. And if so, our intent would be to introduce it separately in the Senate, but we haven't had to deal with that issue yet on the Senate side.
So, Mr. Schroeder, then, if I heard you right, Senator Kelly was the chief author of this legislation. Thank you. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure if the presentation was finished. Are we taking questions on...
We are taking questions at this time.
Okay. Mr. Schroeder, first of all, just so I understand, and I guess I hadn't grasped some of this before, but the bill would allow the commissioner to approve up to 5 organizations, and then those organizations could make proposals. How many proposals could each of the 5 organizations make?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorn, the 5 organizations that the legislation authorizes the commissioner to approve or designate would be sponsors themselves. And they then would act like other nonprofit sponsors, like the Volunteers of America is a sponsor now as a nonprofit organization, or Hamline University, or the St. Paul School District. And so these new organizations could then receive proposals and approve and grant charters. There's no, as there isn't in any other, for any other type of sponsor, there isn't any limit on how many charter schools each of these organizations could grant charters to and oversee. That would be a practical matter that each of these organizations would have to deal with. I guess my own opinion is that the number of schools that each of these sponsors should authorize and oversee should be self-limited. I don't know that we've arrived at a magic number yet in Minnesota. Our largest sponsors now have between 10 and 20 schools, and I think that's getting to be on the upper edge of what's practical and realistic for these organizations to oversee. And if they get much bigger than that, the evidence around the country in other states is that they start to get unnecessarily large and bureaucratic, and we don't want to see that happen in Minnesota.
But there is
no limit.
Mr. Schroeder, point of clarification, do sponsors grant the charters?
I'm sorry?
Do sponsors grant charters?
Well, it's actually a kind of two-step process. Technically, these organizations that we call sponsors do grant the charters, and then under our state charter school law, the State Department of Education also approves each charter, and there's actually a contract that is entered into between the school and the sponsor. So it's a two-step process. First, the chartering authority, the sponsor, approves the charter, and then the State Department also has to approve it.
And my understanding, Mr. Schroeder, is that without both pieces, you have no school. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that sort of leads into the second question that I had that I'm trying to understand. It says the proposals must contain the articles, bylaws, and board membership. How would those proposals for such things as the articles and bylaws and board membership, would they be different from the provisions that are in current law for charter schools in terms of board membership? Why wouldn't they just follow current law for doing those sorts of things?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorn. Again, remember that the provisions here that you're looking at apply to these sponsoring organizations, not the schools. And under this proposal, these sponsoring organizations would have to be 501c3 nonprofit organizations. And then at the time that they apply to the commissioner to be one of the up to 5 designated single-purpose sponsors, this is the information that they would have to present as a part of their proposals. Their bylaws, articles of incorporation, list of directors, how they would be financed, the areas that they would focus on, and so forth.
And Mr. Chairman,
I
had a few more, but also it references the areas of specialization. Is there any place where specialization is defined in terms of what would be considered specialized that they might propose?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorn, I think the answer to your question is no. And that was on purpose. We didn't want the legislature to be telling either the general public or people that might apply to be these single-purpose sponsors or even the commissioner what areas to focus on, what types of schools or what types of student needs or geographic focus or whatever the particular specialization might be. That would come out through the application process and would be in the proposal. So they would say in their application, in addition to this, you know, basic information about the organization itself, they would say that we intend to focus on this type of school or these types of schools. And it wouldn't have to be limited to one. It could be more than one type of school that they would focus on or type of unmet student need. There might be an interest in focusing on small high schools in rural areas. That might be one type of school or type of need that's identified. Or it might focus on schools that ease and facilitate the transition between high school and post-secondary education. There's some very interesting ideas out there about how to do that, connect together into the completion of a high school diploma and an associate degree, say, at a technical college or a community college. Or it might focus on at-risk students, or it might focus on English language learners, or it might focus on early literacy. Now, that might be another focus in elementary or preschool into elementary age programs. So this would really be up to the individuals who are proposing these various single-purpose sponsors, and then the department, of course, would have to decide which ones to approve.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gavney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of questions, both for the author and for Mr. Schroeder. For the author, Representative Dean, Representative Westrum has a bill that goes to the issue of salaries for nonprofit executives and concerns about inflating salaries in that area. And given the history of charter schools with some real egregious examples of financial mismanagement and people kind of looting the system for their own salaries. What is your position on the Western bill?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I have as a client, one of my clients is the Union Gospel Mission, and I suggested to the executive director that his salary may be capped at that of the governor's, and he was delighted at that. So so for some folks, they think it's great. But I will say, I don't have a specific opinion on that bill at this time. I haven't really reviewed it enough to have an opinion on that. But I do realize that there is crossover with this bill.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney.
Representative Dean, looking at page 2, lines 20 through 22, allowing the, actually starting on 18, after the period, the commissioner may terminate its authorization, so on. And it limits the commissioner's ability to terminate a charter for persistent financial mismanagement or repeated violations of law. What was your rationale for carving out an exception to the current law which allows the commissioner to terminate charters for academic failure?
Well, that brings up an important point of the bill because it not only deals with licensure itself and the charter, but also ongoing scrutiny by the department. And so what this would do within that is really give the commissioner broad latitude for termination. And with the specific respect to for termination for academic performance, with the exception, this is encompassing that gives the commissioner pretty broad latitude with specific respect to performance that would be encompassed within that.
Thank you. To this issue, Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dan, I just want to clarify that, again, this provision that you're referencing here applies to the sponsoring organizations, not to the schools themselves. the other provisions of law relating to the circumstances under which a charter can be not renewed or terminated are not affected by this legislation. And these provisions here are consistent with other authority that the commissioner already has to terminate sponsors or their role. So there's really no change intended here in how and under what circumstances schools could be terminated.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Porter, thank you for that clarification. It does surprise me that we would allow chartering organizations to consistently charter underperforming schools to continue to charter, but
Mr. Schrader, is there any change in current law that this bill would bring forward? In other words, does the commissioner still withhold the right to close down chartered schools themselves that are underperforming?
Mr. Chairman, there would be no change in current law for the circumstances under which schools could be terminated.
Thank you. Representative Gavney.
Mr. Schrader, you argue that one of the reasons for this bill is to allow these sponsors to be proactive. What in law today prevents Hamline University from being proactive, or Volunteers of America, or the St. Paul Chamber of Commerce, or, you know, the list of sponsoring organizations? What's preventing them from doing that today?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, there's nothing in the law that prevents them from doing it. And actually, there are varying degrees of activity. I wouldn't call it quite proactivity, but activity by sponsors. The difference, however, is that, again, these are single-purpose sponsors. This is all they do, is grant and oversee charters. This is their line of business. And so, unlike all the other sponsors that we now have, school districts and higher education institutions, nonprofit organizations, that really have much larger fish to fry, you know, much larger aspects to their mission that has to be their proactive focus. And so they're doing this not exactly on the side, that's not fair, because they are taking it seriously, but it's not what they get up in the morning and go to work to do. Hamline University is one of our better higher education sponsors, but they have said that they're now at 4, 5, or 6 somewhere in their schools, and that's probably about enough that they can handle. That's about as much as they can handle. So they're really not looking for new schools to sponsor right now. And even some of our nonprofits, like Volunteers of America, for example, are beginning to feel like they're about at their limits under their current staffing capacity to grant charters. And so there are practical limits on the degree of proactivity that current sponsors can undertake, but not legal limitations. You're correct,
Mr. Chair. One last question,
Representative Gavney.
Thank you. You also argued that the idea was that these would be more rigorous schools. If I understood you correctly, where in the legislation do we get assurances that these would be more rigorous than existing charter schools? I mean, we clearly have a problem in the state with faltering academic performance pretty consistently across charter schools, where many students are doing no better than they were in some struggling regular public schools, and in many cases worse in the charter industry. Where's the assurance in this bill that these schools would be better than the average charter school today?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, without commenting on your premise here about charter school performance, the premise here is that these would be specialized organizations, and so they would focus, this is their livelihood, is granting and overseeing charters, and that is really the premise behind the hope that really the premise that these would be more rigorous, that this is what they do for a living. I mentioned at the beginning that this is not the only piece of legislation that we're supporting this session to strengthen the capacity of sponsors and to improve the performance of sponsors in Minnesota. And we're also not doing that only through legislation. There are initiatives underway, and actually part of the Education Evolving organization is the Minnesota Sponsors Assistance Network that Bob Wadle, the former commissioner, is the director of, which has as its mission strengthening the capacity and performance of existing sponsors. And that's a collaborative project between Education Evolving and the State Department. So there are a number of initiatives underway to strengthen the capacity and performance of sponsors, and I would certainly agree with you that that's an area that we need to focus on, and we are.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. First, just could you comment a little bit on whether or not these sponsoring agents would have any financial oversight over the charter schools?
Mr. Shorter.
Chairman, Representative, they certainly would, just as all sponsors do. This really, again, comes under the general provisions of the charter law relating to sponsorship, and all of the other current obligations of sponsors with respect to oversight of the finances and other aspects of the operations of charter schools would come under the responsibilities of these new organizations. So the answer is yes, they would definitely have that as part of their purpose.
Representative Easton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, it was my understanding that the charter schools have a fairly comprehensive plan for how they establish their boards, and so the money that comes from the state flows to the school, not to the charter agencies. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the boards make the decisions about the finances?
Mr. Shorter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. Under our law, all of the revenues that a charter school receives come directly to it from the state. And then the governing board of the charter school has the authority to decide how to spend that money, of course, within all the parameters of what can be done with public education funding in Minnesota, which are substantial. And then the sponsor provides oversight of that, as does the State Department in terms of the allowable uses of various funding streams and accountability for how the money is actually spent. So there is, as there is for school districts, and charter schools are independent school districts in Minnesota, a fair degree of oversight here, both by the sponsors and also by the State Department in how their money is actually spent.
Representative Eastland.
Okay, it still is a little confusing because it would seem like the board would be the one that would make the decision, not the sponsoring agency. But then I'll go to a second question. The commissioner can terminate the authorization to sponsor, and if that would happen, if the sponsoring agency had been around for a while and sponsored several schools, and all of a sudden the commissioner terminated their authorization for some reason, what happens to the schools?
Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if under current law and practice, if there's a need for there to be a change in sponsor of a school that is not being terminated, the State Department really takes on the responsibility for making sure that that school is not an orphan and make sure that there's another sponsor assigned or that agrees to accept responsibility to sponsor that school. We have a proposal, however, that has not yet been introduced in legislation, but will be, that attempts to clarify that issue, because we have had some schools now and also sponsors that have decided to voluntarily get out of the arrangement that they're in. Either the sponsor doesn't want any longer to be a sponsor and wants to offload the school to some other sponsor, or the school... And not because it's not performing well, but just because it wants to get under a sponsor that's more closely aligned with its mission, desires to change to a different sponsor. And that's been managed, you know, reasonably well, but we have a need to clarify that in the law, and that's something that we would like to see taken up in this session as well. These schools would not be orphans. Under current law, the State Department would ensure that they have a sponsor.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. I'm looking at the handout from Hamline University, and several times there's been a reference to strengthening the capacity of charters, and that could be interpreted, I suppose, in a variety of different ways, but one of the things I noticed in your first paragraph is that these new sponsors would not need the $5 to $2 million in assets that they're currently required of other nonprofits. That doesn't sound like something that strengthens the sponsorship in my view. So if you could comment on two aspects, being you're an expert on charters, why we require the $2 million of other nonprofits, and then why you're proposing under this proposal not to require the $2 million.
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, when the legislature expanded authority to grant charters to nonprofits, I think that was done about 4 or 5 years ago, there was discussion about how would we know that these are legitimate nonprofits that are granting charters and overseeing charters. And there was discussion about, you know, should we put in the law all kinds of things about their capacity and assurances that they would be able to do a good job with this responsibility. And it was decided eventually that the size of the organization would be the trigger, and that we wanted to have substantial established organizations doing this. And so the number $2 million in assets was somewhere pulled out of the air somewhere and put into the law. I don't know that it was based on any sophisticated study of what determines the capacity of nonprofit organizations, but that was what the legislature decided to do at that time. And that's worked reasonably well. We've had quite a number of nonprofits now step forward that meet that requirement, the $2 million in assets, and are willing and have granted charters. So it's not something that we're asking to be changed currently. As far as why these new organizations wouldn't have to meet that that requirement, these are going to be new organizations created solely for this purpose. And so it would be unreasonable to expect that they would be able to accumulate somehow $2 million in assets just right off the top. And that really wouldn't be the determining factor in our view of their capacity. Their capacity is going to be based on, number one, the fact that they focus only on doing this. That's their mission. It's also going to be determined on the strength of their board and the staff, consultants, or what other staff resources they assemble to do this job. And also the capacity is going to be determined or assured by the fact that these are explicitly approved one by one by the commissioner. For the other nonprofits that now can grant charters, if they have $2 million in assets, they can just step forward and do that. They don't have to be approved in advance by the commissioner. These would. And so they would go through a rigorous review process within the department to determine their capacity to actually do that. So that's the trade-off here, that realistically they're new organizations, so we couldn't expect them to have $2 million in assets. But on the other hand, they focus just on this, and they have to be approved one by one by the commissioner.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Carlson.
I was here when we had that discussion, and it is correct that I suspect, in the sense that I don't know what was magic about the $2 million, but we did want to make sure that they did have some financial wherewithal if they were going to begin to sponsor the schools. And, now we're down into this proposal to showing no financial wherewithal. And I think that's, if this bill moves forward, something that the committee should think about, so that there's some viability, if you will, of the sponsors, if not $2 million, at least some other number. You indicated, at least for the current sponsors, which were basically existing organizations, it didn't seem to be a problem. But to go to zero, I think we should think hard and fast about. Mr. Chairman, I had another question. I, too, had noticed that on the reasons for pulling a charter that academic performance was not listed as financial mismanagement or repeated violations of law. And my question of the author, if at some point in the process an amendment were offered, would he be receptive to including academic performance or lack of academic performance, I should say, as being one of the criteria, as it is with other charter schools?
Representative Dean.
Representative Carlson, we'd want to take a careful look and a comparison of what was proposed earlier and here, but we would be open to any amendments, of course.
Okay. Representative Mariano, I'm sorry, Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just again remind the committee that these last criteria here for withdrawing authority apply to the sponsoring organizations, not to the schools. remember that the schools come under a different part of the law and the conditions or circumstances under which they can have their charters terminated or not renewed do include academic performance. These are just intended to apply to these sponsoring organizations.
To this point, Representative Abor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To this point, just to point out, this is about the sponsors, and if they can lose their sponsorship over one school that's performing badly, they may have other ones that are still under their sponsorship. The department, I think, could actually decline to have any more sponsorships by this group and could sanction, I think. So just to be aware as you go down this road, because you might find some unintended consequences.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, my first question was along the lines of Representative Carlson. I run a nonprofit, and when I'm not here, and sometimes when I am here, and it's tough work. And I think that this issue of some kind of financial viability, we shouldn't quickly dismiss it. It's clearly important in the nonprofit world as we, look to establish our credibility with funders and grant makers. And it seems to me that perhaps if this bill moves forward and we're tweaking it to make it better, and let me say that I generally support the effort here, that I think we may want to think about some kind of triggers to guide the commissioner herself. As opposed to just sort of a blank kind of mandate to the commissioner here. And I think that there's probably some room here around the legislature's, what might be an appropriate level of comfort for the legislature in terms of financial viability. There's all sorts of people that get together and form nonprofits, and excuse me, a lot of them aren't solid efforts, if you may. But let me go on to another question here. And it has to do with something you said, Mr. Schroeder, that in terms of some of the sponsors, and I can certainly get that in the nonprofit world you're probably running into some kind of a cap because it's difficult for say, Hamlet or anyone else to sponsor more than one. There's a lot of work involved in this kind of effort. However, there is an area under our charter law where we have a perfect match, and that is that public school districts can sponsor charters. They do get up in the morning specifically focused on running schools. And so my question is, what's been the trend, if any, in the last few years in terms of public school districts' willingness to sponsor charter schools? And I suspect that there's been a hesitancy. I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect there's been a hesitancy. And if there is, what's behind that? What do you think is behind? Because if we had public school districts doing this work, we have so many public school districts, we probably wouldn't need this kind of effort. And so I'm sensing that there's something that we maybe have hit our ceiling in terms of public school districts' willingness to sponsor other schools. So if you could maybe just tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, first to your point about financial capacity, that there is a provision in the law or in the bill here that does require the sources of financing for its operation to be a part of the application. And I think we would be open to discussing more detail that might be included in that part of the application about the capacity, the financial capacity of these applicants. However, I would warn against having assets be a threshold, or that there be an unreasonable threshold here in terms of the size of these organizations in order for them to qualify to apply, because our intent really is that these be new organizations, and as you know, starting a new nonprofit isn't easy in raising money. As to the trends in the role of school districts, of course, we had initially only school districts that could grant charters in Minnesota, and so the early schools were all granted by school districts, and then as the law was expanded to allow others, there seemed to be a shift in the role away from school districts to other higher education institutions and nonprofits that are eligible to grant charters. Right now, we're probably at a really critical point here, and this is more than just interesting, more than just an interesting question about how school districts are going to position themselves for the future. On the one hand, we have some school districts that continue to resist chartering and charter schools in general out of sort of traditional competitive instincts and motivations about money, basically, and students that are moving from one place to another. And we read about that all the time, you know, as school districts are struggling financially in particular, and as enrollment is flat or declining, you know, those competitive pressures become all the more evident. And so that's sort of on the one hand, and it helps to explain why there's been a really substantial fall off in granting of charters by districts. In fact, I think of in the last round, last fall, there were 20-some additional charters granted by that were approved the second time by the State Department, 23, I think, and I believe only one of those was granted by a school district. It was a small school district that had initiated this itself. On the other hand, there is some evidence that some school districts are beginning to see chartering as a management strategy for their own future and to help diversify the offerings, the educational offerings to their students, and to help meet competition from inter-district open enrollment and charters granted by others, and to preserve jobs and enrollment for their own district. And we have some examples of that, actually.
Mr. Schroeder, we're running out of time
here. So it's on the one hand. On the other hand, some I think the general trend is away from chartering by districts, but there are some districts that are actually starting to do this proactively.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, and I know you want to move on here, but it seems to me that one of the things we ought to be doing, either in conjunction with this bill and some of the other bills, is to explore ways in which the legislature can assist school districts in getting over some of the hesitancy issues in a helpful way in terms of sponsoring charters, or even strategically thinking about how charter schools fit within their broad management scheme. Just one quick question, if I may. Mr. Schroeder, I suspect that the kind of people who put together a charter school would be different in makeup, I think, than the kind of folks that would be willing to do this level of work. What would be, just say, an example say we were to authorize this, what would be an example in your mind of, you know, knowing what's out there, of the kind of folks that would come together to create such a sponsoring organization?
Mr. Schroeder.
Chairman Representative Mariani, actually we have had conversations with some people who may have an interest in doing this, and it would be people who are experienced educators, but also in the management of schools. It could be former administrators, district-level administrators, or building-level administrators, others with strong nonprofit experience and management experience. In some cases, it might be people who have an interest in the particular mission of the school, who come out of a background in dealing with at-risk students or whatever the unmet need is. So you're right, it's somewhat different, although ideally will be people who have experience in starting and operating schools, whether it's in the charter sector or the district sector, because that's a really important set of qualifications for doing this job.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Representative Colson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just want to state my support for this bill, and my support stems from my year as a teacher in a charter school, which was just getting its start, and I sat on the board as we were trying to get that school going, and we did have a very good sponsor, but that sponsor was a higher education institution that oftentimes said, wow, you know, this is so new to us because, you know, this isn't our, K-12 is not our bag. And they also often said, you know, we've got to be working on higher ed over here and K-12 over here. And they said this is almost a full-time job trying to sponsor this school. And we had a good relationship with them, but I definitely can see where these single-purpose sponsors are going to be an excellent way to provide the support to the schools, the charter schools, that maybe are finding themselves in financial debt. Maybe they won't because they've got this very focused, single-purpose sponsor. Also, with the commissioner on lines 15 and 16, looking at the effectiveness of the sponsor in promoting student achievement, I think that with that scrutiny going on, as well as the scrutiny of the commissioner over the sponsors for financial management, I'm not concerned, I guess, about the integrity of the single-purpose sponsors, and I see just such great things that could happen for charter schools. And it's really just based on my experience of having been there that first year with a charter school and knowing how important the sponsor relationship is for the success of that school. So I just wanted to take time to share that. And I did hear a lot of questions today that are confusing the sponsor with the charter school itself. And I think that we need to keep those a little bit separate because they have very different purposes in terms of the charter.
Mm-hmm. Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chairperson, my original question is from Charleston, but now I want to expand just a bit on the idea of the sponsors. They're nonprofits. They don't have to have any financial resources, and you're talking about administrators and others. How do those people, are they all volunteers that are going to do this, or what's their source of income? Do they have a source of income? Where would they derive their income? And or is this full-time work on the volunteer work on the part of the sponsors?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, the founders of these organizations and the board members, as is typical with nonprofits, would most likely be volunteers. However, the intent here is that there be professional staffing for these organizations, and that they would be compensated. And the income, initially, there would have to be some startup funding for each of these organizations, and we've made the commitment here that we're not coming to the legislature for operating support, general operating support from the legislature, from the state. So the understanding is that these would be privately financed or financed from sources other than state revenues initially. And then, as is true for all charter school sponsors, there would be revenues coming from the schools. And under our current law, sponsors can charge schools up to $30 in their initial years and $10 per student in the subsequent years. And actually, one of the other bills that we would like to bring before you would make a change in how sponsors are financed, and that would apply to these as well. We do believe that there needs to be a change that would provide additional resources to these sponsoring organizations, but it would come from the schools.
Representative Peterson.
So you're saying there would be a management fee charged to the charter school? That's your intent at some point.
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, it would be under current law. We're not in this legislation, and these particular sponsors would not be treated differently from other sponsors. Right now, if this was created today, they would be able to charge the schools up to $30 per student in their initial years and then $10 per year after that. That would apply to these sponsors as well as all other sponsors, school districts, and all other sponsors that currently exist.
Representative Carlson.
Actually, that last part of the discussion is what I was going to ask about, but no. It does put out the case. You said you have other legislation in the pipeline where they're going to ask for an increase for this oversight. This question came up when we visited the charter school Rambler University Avenue. It was pointed out that Hamlin was spending probably $30 per student for some of the oversight. We have, Mr. Chairman, a lot of expectations of this group. That's why I asked about that. $2 million, you know, and now we're having a discussion about hiring professional staff, assuming a volunteer board. I assume when you start a private nonprofit, you're going to probably incur some just the mere establishment of a charter and the advice and all of that. It's a little fuzzy to me on how this whole thing is going to be financed. So I guess my question at this point would be, how do you envision that taking place? Where is the money when we don't have an asset test going to come from for the hiring of that professional staff? I assume that your comments about other legislation to change that $30 fee somewhere is being talked about or in the pipeline. What do you see as the future of the financing of one of these organizations?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson. This is a very important issue right now, even aside from this legislative proposal, because it affects our current sponsors, Hamlin and others. But the, as I said, the startup funding for these new sponsoring organizations, until they get schools from which they could draw revenue, would have to come from grants or other sources. Other than we've said we would not come to the legislature for general state revenue for these sponsoring organizations. And the individuals that are putting these organizations together obviously would have, that would be one of their primary responsibilities, just like the board of any nonprofit organization. Raising money for their initial startup would be an important part of their obligations. Once they begin to work with schools and have granted charters, then they will have an income stream from those schools. And you know, this is a business plan question, because it will be resolved over time, as depending on the number of schools that you get and, you know, the income that's generated by the schools that you're sponsoring. So it's something that, you know, that the boards of the organizations and the management of these organizations are going to have to work out, just like any nonprofit. But the plan is that there would be grants initially or other sources than general state revenues for their initial startup, and then their operating revenues would come from the schools.
Members, just to let you know what I plan to do here. All right, we have two people that have asked to share their comments on this bill. We're going to hear from them now. I'm going to ask them, try and keep their comments to about 2 minutes. At that time, I'm going to lay this bill over. All right. We'll approve the minutes, we'll adjourn, we'll start up on Thursday with this bill, all right, and bring it to conclusion. So, gentlemen, if you want to step aside, we'll take testimony from Ms. Walschweiger, welcome back, and from Mr. Aronson.
Mr. Chairman and members, In my 1 minute here, let me say a couple things about
this. Mr. Aronson, please introduce yourself for the page.
Chairman, I'm Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary School Principals Associations. And we've watched the charter movement for a long time. I've been here since these started. And when the initial outline of charter schools was that we would have 8 public school districts that would be the sponsors, and in fact the schools would have to be located in the district where the sponsor was. This is as far away from that as we've come. I think the committee should, and the questions show that there's an appreciation for this. These aren't public corporations that will sponsor these charter schools. They are nonprofits, but they're not public. They're not subject to the open meeting law. They're not subject to the Government Data Practices Act. There's a reference in here that says, you know, the commissioner can shut them down if the sponsoring agencies engage in persistent financial mismanagement or repeated violations of law, but there's no ongoing reporting requirements for the commissioner to even know about any of those things. Once the commissioner approves these applications, then these private, nonprofit corporations, that's what they are, can go out and do the sponsoring. You are going to spend money, create a bureaucracy, to have these folks run these schools. You don't have publicly elected boards as we have with public schools. There's very little left about this other than the money that is public. The folks haven't talked to you about who the people are that want to form these corporations and come forward to the commissioner. Obviously, the commissioner would in good faith review these, but this is buying something behind curtain number two. We think it's a bad idea and that you ought not do it.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Allswiger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. And I would certainly welcome the opportunity to come back and discuss this issue again or to give testimony on Thursday when we have adequate time to give our testimony. I know that Mr. Aronson has far more information to share as well. So I'm going to go back. I have been testifying on charter schools for the last 10 years. And every time I testify, I say this. Education Minnesota is not opposed to charter schools. We feel that there is some value and there are some opportunities there. However, we have also said almost every year, please check into charter schools, hold them accountable. We know that there are situations where there is fiscal mismanagement, there are concerns about instructional and curriculum type issues. And we've asked you, please, in this time of accountability, before you expand the number of charter schools and this incredible opportunity for charter schools to expand with these nonprofits, to please examine what is happening in the schools in terms of fiscal management, instructional issues, who is sponsoring, who should be the best sponsor, and who is effective. When they started charter schools, the legislature said, we want to have another public system so that we can learn about what works for kids. Have another system where you could be free of some of the rules, laws, regulations, and see if it makes a difference. What report have you seen that gives you that information? And before you expand, we would ask you to look into that more closely. And we would love the opportunity to give this the testimony that this bill deserves.
Thank you, members. At this time, the chair will go over this bill for future consideration. Members, in your packet are the minutes from the February 24th meeting. Representative Wardlow moves approval of the minutes. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Members, this committee meeting is adjourned.